listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The U.S. is apparently pulling out of Syria. The latest tweet from President Donald Trump said, quote, "After historic victories against ISIS, it's time to bring our great young people home," closed quote. We begin with this report from Dan Cohen, given to RT on Wednesday.
We now have official confirmation that U.S. troops will be leaving Syria. Now, there are at least 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria, and removing them would be fulfillment of one of President Trump's campaign promises. Now, Vice President Mike Pence and the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, are meeting right now in the Pentagon. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders released a statement saying the process of returning troops back to the U.S. has actually already begun. Now, the statement also says that this doesn't signal the end of the global coalition to defeat ISIS or its campaign. Now, ISIS has been defeated in the sense it holds no territory. Perhaps President Trump is overstating the U.S. role in that effort. ISIS was largely defeated by the Syrian and Russian militaries, along with the Lebanese group Hezbollah. Now, the timing here is very curious. Turkey is threatening an offensive on U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in northern Syria, and President Erdogan has demanded that the U.S.-backed forces withdraw and said that the operation to attack them could start any moment. So Turkey is unlikely to attack U.S. forces, and this could very much factor into President Trump's decision to remove American forces.
Meanwhile, a major development was announced after a meeting between Syria, Russia, Iran, and Turkey towards a political settlement of the crisis in Syria. This was Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, on Wednesday.
We have very useful meeting with the Secretary General Special Envoy, agreed to take efforts aimed at convening the first session of the Constitutional Committee in Geneva early next year. These steps will lead to the launch of a viable and lasting Syrian-led, Syrian-owned, and UN-facilitated political process.
RT's Murad Gazdiev has more.
In their closing statement, the three foreign ministers of Russia, Iran, and Turkey wrote that they presented the positive results of their consultations on the formation of a Syrian constitutional committee to either rewrite the Syrian constitution or to amend it in order to allow for a wider pan-Syrian election, presidential election, part of a political resolution to this war that has raged on for so many years. The ministers themselves, from what we saw, were smiling and laughing afterwards. They described their work as, again, positive, and they have committed to seeing the Syrian Constitutional Committee sit for its first session early next year, early 2019. We hope, of course, that they'll be able to do this, because this trio that have been working together for several years now, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, they've been able to produce results, yield concrete results. We've seen ceasefires in Syria established with their backing. We've seen withdrawals, other deals, de-escalations, demilitarized zones established all over Syria. So there's a lot of optimism going forward that they'll be able to get the rebels, the opposition, and the Syrian government to work together. Earlier on, the Turkish foreign minister, though, did remark that they had seen very little cooperation from the United States and the coalition that it leads. The United States itself has shared its goals, has publicly stated that its aims with regards to Syria have shifted, and it no longer sees unseating President Bashar al-Assad or regime change in Syria as a goal.
We're not asking for regime change. We're not asking for the Russians to leave. What we're asking for is a compromise settlement. There's a strong readiness on the part of Western nations not to ante up money for that disaster unless we have some kind of idea that the government is ready to compromise and thus not create yet another horror in the years ahead.
Nevertheless, the situation in Syria remains volatile, especially now with Turkey threatening to intervene, to invade northern Syria out of security concerns, as they see the YPG, Syrian Kurds that control much of northern Syria, as a terrorist organization, and they have threatened to act. We're also seeing sporadic fighting in Idlib with jihadists joined by rebels there and the Syrian Arab army clashing from time to time. So there's certainly motivation to get things done.
The U.S. Special Representative for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, spoke on Tuesday about the situation in that country.
I believe that there is an extra mile to go. An extra mile to go. In the marathon effort to ensure the necessary package for a credible, balanced, an inclusive constitutional committee, and for including a balanced chairing arrangement and drafting body and voting threshold to be established under the UN auspices in Geneva. These consultations were a key part of our own intensive effort at the request of the Secretary General to fundamentally advance the possibility of establishing a Syrian-owned, Syrian-led, UN-facilitated constitutional committee in order to draft for a popular approval a constitutional reform as contribution to the political settlement in Syria that gives effect to the Sochi final statement of 30 January 2018, within the context of the Geneva process to implement Security Council Resolution 2254. I'm not tired, I'm not frustrated. In our job, we cannot afford to be frustrated. Otherwise, you will never be a mediator. You can't be a doctor and be frustrated by diseases. But I did so because at a certain point, there is a need to draw a line on your personal life as well, at least for a period. And B, because I found a excellent successor who I know will be not only doing along the lines of what we've done, but do even better.
Meanwhile, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Nikolai Mladenov, gave the UN Security Council Monday a year-end report on the status of peace negotiations between Israel and Palestine.
The continued expansion of the Israeli settlement enterprise in all of its aspects is illegal under international law, undermines hope among the population, trust between the parties, and the two-state solution itself. And each time, as the parties came frighteningly close to the brink of war, tireless efforts by Egypt and the United Nations prevented a full-fledged conflict, ultimately reuniting Gaza and the West Bank under a single, legitimate and democratic Palestinian authority, and putting an end to the occupation will ensure long-term peace. Meanwhile, however, it is imperative that the current calm be preserved at all costs. No one can afford another war in Gaza. Ongoing instances of incitement, provocative steps and inflammatory rhetoric plague the public language of the conflict. They are highly dangerous and threaten to push an already volatile situation past the boiling point. I believe that I speak on behalf of all of us today when I say that we all share a concern that at the end of 2018, we're nowhere closer to reviving efforts for a negotiated solution. Without a political horizon, all our collective and individual efforts merely contribute to managing the conflict rather than resolving it.
Following that report, the following comments were delivered to the media Monday by Ambassador Riyad Mansour, Palestine's permanent representative to the United Nations, on the situation in his country.
In the debate that took place, we agree with some of the points that were raised by Mr. Mladenov. Of course, we disagree with him on other issues. And we support the 10 countries who have reiterated their request that the report should have been in writing by the Secretary General and circulated to member states ahead of time to be able to have a very constructive and positive debate in the Security Council on the basis of a written report. Let me also say that the Ambassador of the United States gave her last speech. And her last speech is similar to her first speech when she came to the Security Council 2 years ago. She has been trying for 2 years to convince members of the Security Council and the international community to abandon international law, to abandon the global consensus of how to solve this problem in which the international community spent at least 25 years building, which is the parameter. The two-state solution, ending occupation, just solution to the refugee questions, and all the elements of the global consensus. She reiterated this position in her last speech before departure this time, and the 14 other members of the Security Council upheld the international law, Security Council resolution, including 2334, and she failed again in not convincing a single one of them of replacing the global consensus of how to solve the problem by the ideas and the thinking of President Trump, in which she said she read the plan, but she did not share anything that was clear. And in essence, she wanted the thinking of President Trump to replace the global consensus, and not a single country in the Security Council approved or agreed with her on that articulation. So as she is leaving, as she came in, she did not succeed in changing the thinking of the Security Council, definitely not the 14 members of the Security Council. And in all of her tenure, the 2 years, she did not criticize a single action or policy by Israel in the occupied territory. And this way, she shifted the position of the United States to be identical with the position of Israel, and therefore contributed to the isolation of the United States from the other members of the Security Council and marginalizing their effectiveness in playing a very positive role in solving this conflict. As we end the year, I just want to say last year was a very difficult year for us because the United States administration took very belligerent unilateral positions starting from Jerusalem, going through UNRWA and refugees against the Palestinian people and their cause. And I am satisfied to say the U.S. administration did not succeed in the destruction of UNRWA. In the contrary, the international community is defending UNRWA very strongly and was able to come up with a deficit of $440 million when the United States decided not to pay $300 million of it as they have promised at the beginning of the year. The deficit today is $21 million. They did not succeed in fundamentally changing the thinking of the United Nations on the global consensus. The international community, as one see it in the many resolutions adopted and in the position of the Security Council, they are still upholding these positions, and the position of the United States along with Israel is extremely isolated. And I am happy to say that the Palestinian people were able to withstand this onslaught and succeed on the adoption of all of their resolutions with fundamentally the same essence and fundamentally very similar voting pattern to the year before and the year before. If you have any question, I'm available to you. Yes, sir.
It carries on very neat to what we were talking about in terms of UNRWA managing to stop the deficit in funding. But you've got other funding issues, or rather the UN Aid Office announced yesterday a reduction in its 2019 spending plan. So it's gone down by 200 million, and there's 500,000 fewer Palestinians are going to be receiving aid, particularly in Gaza. What does that say about your support with international donors, but also what does that look like on the ground in places like Gaza City, Ramallah, and so on for 2019 in terms of the humanitarian situation? Is it looking bleak for you guys?
No, it is not. Even in the one listen to the debate, that there was a clear message that as we were collectively able, you know, to withstand this onslaught by the current U.S. administration by denying $300 million to UNRWA, $25 million to hospitals in East Jerusalem, and also further reduction to the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian people were able to receive a massive political support from the international community and financial support. One example is bridging, you know, the deficit of UNRWA from $440 million to $21 million. The same message is going to be transferred to the year 2019, next year, and we sincerely hope that this political support and financial support would continue. And let me also add that we are grateful to the international community by putting their trust on us to lead the G77 in the year 2019. It's a grouping of 134 countries, that's including China, and populated by these countries of 80% of humanity, to put such a trust on us to lead the humanity in negotiations of 70% of the agenda of the UN, which is the developmental agenda, is a great honor for the Palestinian people. And I am delighted to announce that President Mahmoud Abbas will be here on 15th of January to receive the baton from our Egyptian brothers as a leader of the G77 and China for the year 2019.
Ambassador, sorry, I was in the daily press briefing. Yes. Do you mind if I ask a question about Ambassador Haley? I hope you don't mind me recalling the fact that you've been here quite a long time. You've seen many U.S. ambassadors come and go. If you look at those ambassadors that you've dealt with over the years, and then compare Ambassador Haley with the others that you've dealt with, where does she go on the league table in your mind of ambassadors that you've dealt with from the United States?
I think in part I addressed this issue before you came, but let me just say that unfortunately with the this current representative, well, actually she is leaving us, as also reflecting the policies of the current U.S. administration, her style was more aggressive and more pro-Israelis than perhaps the style of others. She was acting as being more Israelis than the Israeli representative himself, which is very unfortunate. We know that different representatives of the United States of America were always showing massive support to Israel, but yet in the same time they were a bit more balanced in terms of not ignoring the Palestinian side completely. Ambassador Haley unfortunately exhibited, you know, excessive amount of hostility to the Palestinian people and to the Palestinian cause, and she crusaded to replace the global consensus with her ideas, and I suppose also the ideas of President Trump. And I can say after 2 years she failed in convincing any significant number of countries at the United Nations with these ideas. The last one was her speech today in the Security Council, in which she repeated the same themes that she started with 2 years ago, and she did not convince any of the 14 members of the Security Council to replace the global consensus with other ideas, because the 14 others and the great majority of the international community said that we invested a lot during the tens of years in the past, including with U.S. representatives and previous administration, in reaching this global consensus. And as it was articulated by our European colleagues who spoke here before me, you know, earlier this morning, that they said that they don't see anything to replace ending the occupation, two-state solution, and the parameter to be able to be taken seriously and to succeed. Any other ideas that might be contemplated by the current U.S. administration to replace this global consensus, as one to listen closely to what was debated inside the General Assembly Hall, it indicates that it will not have a chance of succeeding. It's dead on arrival. She refused to listen to these positions that she heard for the last 2 years, and she left without listening to them, insisting that the replacement of the global consensus with something that is so vague, which we don't know, will succeed. She is wrong. It will not succeed. The only thing that has a chance of success is to implement the global consensus. Thank you.
On Tuesday, Israel's permanent representative to the UN, Danny Danone, spoke with the media on the situation between Israel and Lebanon.
Hello, good morning. Today we are addressing Hezbollah's terror tunnel network, which the terrorist organization has been able to build despite the presence of the Lebanese armed forces and UNIFIL. There have been 38 reports on Resolution 1701. At the Security Council last year, I exposed Hezbollah's violations. Yet, unbelievably, Major General Bibi, the former UNIFIL commander, had stated, and I quote, during a visit on the border with the IDF officials and Ambassador Haley, General Bibi said, "The region is calm, the situation is good, there is no need to change. The facts, however, are clear, the situation is not good. We need to see a change." On UNIFIL's watch, Hezbollah has been digging tunnels from Lebanese villages such as Kfar Kela and using its own people as human shields. Israel even revealed to UNIFIL that a high-ranking member of the Lebanese armed forces actively cooperates with Hezbollah. When UNIFIL told the Lebanese army about the tunnels, the Lebanese army sent the information straight to Hezbollah immediately, which then sealed the tunnels to destroy the evidence. These tunnels cross the blue line in violation of Israel's sovereignty. They are designed for one purpose, to attack Israel and terrorize its citizens. This is part of Hezbollah's plan to invade the Galilee, our northern part, and destroy Israel. We know this because in 2013, Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's Secretary General, publicly discussed this operation, and he called it Conquest of the Galilee. 2 weeks ago, the IDF launched Operation Northern Shield to neutralize and destroy these tunnels. So far, the IDF has uncovered four that cross the blue line. You can see from their locations here in the map, you can see the tunnels coming from Lebanon into Israel next to our communities. Some of the tunnels are only meters from UNIFIL observation points. You can see that it perfectly aligns with Nasrallah's operations. This is no coincidence. What you are seeing is Hezbollah's conquest of the Galilee battle plan in action. This is just the ground component of an offensive that will use Hezbollah's arsenal, over 100,000 rockets and missiles, to strike all of Israel. Make no mistake, if Hezbollah forces our hand, we will act swiftly, and we will do it with full force. Thank you.
Ambassador, it's Pamela Falk from CBS News. Your prime minister has called for UN action. Can you see anything happening at the Security Council on these tunnels or on Hezbollah generally? Thank you.
Well, first, I think the Security Council should designate Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, the same way the Security Council designated Al-Qaeda, ISIL, and other terrorist organizations. That's what we expect from the Security Council, a clear condemnation. But also, we expect them to say something to Lebanon, to the sovereign government of Lebanon. But because if, God forbid, there will be an escalation and there will be casualties on those villages in southern Lebanon, and I will reveal more information in the council, the Security Council will convene and blame Israel. Today, they should demand more from the Lebanese government.
Thank you. Mr. Ambassador, what have the Lebanese said, if they've said anything in advance of this meeting, either Hezbollah or the supposedly sovereign government of Lebanon? Are they asserting a right to invade or penetrate a neighboring state through or under a recognized international border, or what have any of them said?
Well, I believe that Hezbollah took over part of the government of Lebanon. We are waiting to hear the Lebanese ambassador speaking to the council in a few minutes. She wrote a letter to the council complaining about Israel, but we haven't heard them speaking publicly about Hezbollah. And it is about time that they will confront Hezbollah. For the sake of the people of Lebanon, they should confront Hezbollah.
Ambassador, can we ask you about another issue of pressing concern right now? There are reports that President Trump is planning to pull all the U.S. troops out of Syria. In your assessment, is the threat from ISIL in Syria finished? And are you concerned about Israel's security if those troops leave Syria?
Well, it is a U.S. decision. We will respect any decision made by the administration. We have our concerns about Syria, about the presence of Iranian troops in Syria, and we will do whatever is necessary to protect our people, regardless if you have American troops, Russian troops, or any other nations. So we will continue to follow our policy of not allowing the Iranians to build their bases next to our borders.
You mentioned Iran. What about ISIL? Is ISIL defeated in Syria, in Israel's estimation?
Well, for sure we can tell that ISIS has been defeated in Syria. You can argue whether it's completed or not, but overall we can agree with the international community that the fight against ISIS...
Russia announced that it is prepared for a U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty. Press TV's Marina Kortanova has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that Russia can easily make and deploy land-based intermediate-range missiles if the U.S. withdraws from the Nuclear Arms Control Treaty. The Russian leader said if the United States leaves the INF Treaty, Russia will be able to modernize air and sea-based systems by placing them on land complexes. Experts say Moscow has all power and infrastructure for a tit-for-tat move against Washington.
Russia has sea-based launchers that can easily be deployed on land and in which missiles can be placed. It has all the necessary components for the development of the infrastructure for the use of medium-range missiles of caliber NK and the ability to produce such missiles in the required quantity in order to create an adequate threat to the United States and Europe, the Middle East, and other regions.
Putin accused the U.S. of violating the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty by placing its missile systems in Romania and Poland. Russia's response has been its recent advances in creation of new types of weapons that have no analogies in the world.
Let's see how this will happen. By and large, we already have everything. But if something happens that is trying to frighten us, well, we will have to respond accordingly.
Russia says it's not in breach of INF Treaty and that it's the United States who is violating it. Experts also say it's the Trump administration that will be blamed for tearing the treaty up. The U.S. president has already a disappointing track record of abandoning landmark deals clinched by his predecessors from the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement to treaties on trade and climate change.
In 1987, the USSR and the USA signed the Treaty on the Elimination of Intermediate-Ranged and Shorter-Ranged Missiles. Then the world stood on the edge, and it seemed that this would not happen again. The Soviet Union was unilaterally disarmed, while the United States continued to build up its naval, air, and land-based weapon systems. The leadership of the Soviet Union agreed to this unilateral disarmament, but modern Russia does not intend to make such mistakes in the future. Marina Kortanova, Press TV, Moscow.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The U.S.-China trade war seems to be averted for the time being, but will the truce last? Well, I ask Robert Manning, former advisor to the U.S. government and a participant of the 2018 EMERTEC International Conference.
As the global trade war between the U.S. and China is put on hold, the parties stay poised for the next round in talks, with neither side showing any real desire for major concessions. Where will the Washington-Beijing standoff lead the two world powers? How will a continuing trade conflict between economic giants impact on the rest of the world? And can economics have a military fallout?
Robert Manning, great to have you with us on this program.
My pleasure.
All right, so after the G20 summit, President Trump said an incredible deal with China has been made. Now, the Chinese, they announced rolling back some tariffs, and they're being ready for another round of talks, but they're not giving any specific details out. Do you think the deal is really that incredible, as Trump says it is?
Well, despite the fact that Trump said it, it might be true. And I think that this was worked out before the G20 by various cabinet officials. And I think we're starting to see the Chinese announced purchases of more agricultural goods. I suspect you will see them also announce purchases of long-term natural gas. They announced an opening of a range of sectors to foreign investment. And I think the whole set of issues around technology, we're beginning to see things at least being talked about. Most of the things that the U.S. has demanded, if you go back and read the speeches Xi Jinping has made going back to the 19th Party Congress, if he actually did what he said, there wouldn't be much of a problem. And I think now he's being tested. And that's not just the United States. I think that China's mercantilist policies have been a source of concern in Europe, in Japan, and elsewhere, that the Chinese have just kind of overplayed their hand. Even there's a quiet debate amongst the Chinese elite, where one worrying that Xi has overplayed his hand, and I think we're beginning to see him walking it back a little
bit.
But
let's bring this back into the realm of U.S. and China relations, because I do agree what you're saying about Europe and Japan, but I want to talk more about China and U.S. because meanwhile, okay, the talks are in progress and the second round of talks are somewhere close, but meanwhile, the daughter of the founder of the tech giant Huawei, who's also second in command there, has been arrested at a request for American request for violating U.S. trade rules and anti-Iran sanctions. I mean, Huawei is linked tightly with China's government. And even though China says that the arrest won't stop the trade talks with Washington, why the need to complicate things? I mean, things were just getting better. You're just about to hammer out a deal or so. Won't this arrest derail the year-long negotiations?
Well, I think you're assuming more coherence within the U.S. government than might be prudent. We have an independent judiciary. The Justice Department does. In fact, Trump didn't even know she was arrested at the time he was having dinner with Xi at the G20.
Yeah, I know. John Bolton said that he didn't pass the news of imminent arrest to President Trump. I mean, I do understand that, you know, presidents shouldn't be looking into every single detail of everything that's going on, but this is a big deal.
Well,
it's like Bill Gates' daughter being arrested in China or something like that.
Right, but I don't think you have a similar situation. The Chinese have a lot more control over all those sorts of things. I think also the Justice Department announced a whole range of sanctions against Chinese hacking exercises and so on. This is part of a broader U.S. attempt to push back on Chinese technology, mercantilism, stealing IPR, and so on over the, I think Trump is obviously using it as leverage in these trade talks, but I do think that you have the two largest economies in the world, very intertwined in ways that you have some people in the Trump administration that are very anti-China, that want an economic divorce. I would note that in a rare occasion, Trump has actually appointed somebody to be in charge, the USTR Lighthizer, and because all of his advisors have different trade policies.
Absolutely. Lighthizer says he wants more tariffs against China, and Mnuchin says that trade war should be evaded. And then you have Peter Navarro, who is a trade advisor. He says that Trump, be careful, don't enter a hollow deal. So ultimately, who decides what to do?
Well, as I say, I think that's why they appointed Lighthizer. I think for the Chinese, it's been very troubling, because historically on our China policy, there's been somebody in charge, so the Chinese know who to go to. For example, in the Bush administration, it was Treasury Secretary Paulson. And we had a pretty good way of managing these issues. In the Trump administration, no one's in charge, and there's several different voices with different policies, and it's been very difficult for the Chinese. First, they made a deal with Commerce Secretary Ross, and then Trump vetoed it. Then they made a deal with our Treasury Secretary, and Trump vetoed that. So from the Chinese perspective, it's like, what do we have to do? Who do we talk to? And I think Trump, then now we've, I think, begun to answer that question with the appointment of Lighthizer.
I want to get back a little bit on the arrests of the daughter of the owner of Huawei. Like I said, for me, it's like an analogy as if Bill Gates' daughter was arrested in China for breaching Chinese trade rules. Surely it would make the U.S. given more concessions to China if that were to happen. I feel like, why do Americans think they can strong-arm Beijing like that?
Well, she wasn't arrested the way the Chinese picked up Canadians in retaliation. She was taken into custody because of sanctions violations in terms of fraud Huawei conducted in doing business with Iran through a subsidiary.
Right, but okay, I can't just stop for a second and notice that companies like Ericsson and Samsung, who also sell to Iran, aren't being sanctioned and people aren't being arrested from them. I mean, this is hardly, it's only obvious this is a political thing because, you know, this prosecution is very selective.
I think we've sanctioned a lot of other countries.
But I'm talking about companies. I just gave you two examples, Samsung, well, Ericsson, they're selling to Iran.
I think Huawei has a problem, not just with the United States. Over the past several months, they've been rejected in the UK, in New Zealand, Australia, Japan is now in the process of thinking of doing away with Huawei as a 5G carrier. So I think there's a lot of concern about Chinese technology practices more broadly, and I think that's one of the reasons we're beginning to see these trade talks kind of get traction, because I think the Chinese big tech is not that different from American big tech. If you're Alibaba or Baidu or Tencent, you want access to global markets. China's only 14% or so of the world market. They want access to the other 86%. And I suspect that they, the fact that they're being shut out of markets, that their efforts to acquire by FDI tech firms has been rejected in a number of countries, they've probably gone to the leadership in China and said maybe this isn't working so well.
So the White House has given Beijing 90 days to, as they put it, to actually make things right. Mm-hmm. And that means reform their technology rules, open up to U.S. services. But, I mean, these are the demands that U.S. has battling with China for decades. I mean, isn't it naive to think that in 90 days it's just going to all be good?
Yeah, well, I would be surprised if that happened in 90 days. I think the way at least some people in the administration are looking at it, it's more like a trial period. They want to be able in 90 days to see if the Chinese are serious this time about actually following through on commitments. You know, they've made a number of commitments. Xi pledged to Obama to stop cyber hacking. Didn't happen. In fact, it's been increasing in recent months. So I think Xi has a credibility problem, and not just with the United States. And so I think this 90 days will serve as a way for the U.S. to make a judgment about whether the Chinese are serious or not.
So the Americans, they've been actually complaining about China pinching American technology for years, right? And maybe it helped foster Chinese technological progress. But now they're investing more and more in research, and they're producing more tech graduates than America and Europe taken together. Will China even need to play loose with this foreign technology anymore?
Well, I think China's no longer a copycat. I think they're leading. In fact, I've done a major report on global innovation where I called China the new Silicon Valley. And I think that we're seeing in a number of areas in terms of, and all you can see the metrics in terms of number of patents, number of scientific papers, and so on. And in some areas in their artificial intelligence and others, I mean, they lead the world in e-payments. Half the electronic payments in the world occur in China, something like 42 million. I think it's they've become a serious actor on their own, and I think their attitudes on IPR are changing because now they have their own IPR to protect.
So here's the thing. You said that American and Chinese markets are so intertwined and their economies are so closely working together. They need each other. They need each other's markets, investors. How far can the two even push each other until it gets to a point where they'll be shooting themselves into their foot?
Well, I think you'll see a slightly diminished relationship, but I think it's more than a bilateral issue. The U.S. and China account for about 45% of all world trade. If the two largest trading powers are playing by different rules, what kind of international architecture and trade regime, what's the future of the WTO? So these are big global issues, and I think that how this plays out will have a big impact both regionally and globally on the trade architecture around the world.
So in the beginning of 2018, you wrote that current global trade regime is at risk. You're referring to Trump's protectionism, unilateral attitude towards WTO, pacts like TPP, NAFTA. But, you know, year is coming to a close, and we actually see that U.S.-China progress is here, and that they're talking. There are NAFTA talks, and then, you know, people are selling or still buying. Would you still say that the world trade system is in danger?
Yes, I think it's very much in danger. The crown jewel, the WTO, the dispute mechanism, is at risk. The U.S. has blocked new judges because it wants as a way to leverage reform, and we have less than a year to go. If we don't get this fixed, the whole system may not be working, and then we're back to instead of rules-based trade, power-based trade.
We're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Robert Manning, former advisor to the U.S. government. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Robert Manning, former advisor to the U.S. government and participant of the 2018 EmerTech International Conference. Mr. Manning, this approach toward China, a hawkish approach, it's not just in terms of economy, right? We're also hardware as well, because we see this in the South China Sea. There's already too many bomber flies and warships sailing back and forth. Can the trade war thaw lead to actually to an easing of tensions in terms of the region?
Well, I think the old consensus going back to the Nixon opening is gone. I think up until Trump, all of previous American presidents felt that what China's success was good for the United States. Trump is the first one who's had a different view on that. And I think the trade had been the foundation of the relationship. The strongest advocates for U.S.-China relations were the U.S. business community. If you go back over the last several years and read U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Beijing or Shanghai, their reports, they found it harder and harder to do business, more and more disconcerted efforts and frustration. And so they're less supportive. If we have new trade arrangements with China, that may build a new foundation for more stable relations. I think broadly, the U.S. has a problem in accepting the rise of China, no matter what they do. I think a lot of people in the U.S. the status quo as some eternal development.
Right. So, what is America's end game in the South China region, South China Sea?
Well, you know, the Chinese are the ones who signed the Law of the Sea Treaty and then decided to interpret it kind of on an a la carte sort of basis. And, you know, they pledged to Obama that they wouldn't militarize the South China Sea, and they've built a whole series of military bases, building up disputed islets. I think the U.S. and China both have a problem. Neither side has answered what I see as two basic questions that will shape the future. The Chinese assumption is the U.S. is an outlier and it'll eventually leave, and they're positioning themselves to be a dominant power in the region. The U.S. seems to think that its network of alliances and presence in the region, which has only been there for the last 70 years, if you think about the last 5,000 years of Asian history, there have been three different kinds of security systems. For a long time, it was Chinese tributary system. Then we had an imperialist system in the beginning of the 20th century. And after World War II, it's been American dominance. And from an Asian perspective, that's a short period of time. It's not the norm. It's the exception. And so I think the question is, what type of Chinese presence and role is acceptable to the U.S.? And flip it around the other way for China. Once they understand Americans are not leaving, we're a Pacific power, what type of American role and presence can China live with? Those are two big strategic questions that neither side has answered.
And on its own right, Beijing is active in the South China Sea. It has an arsenal to counter U.S. carriers, we know that, and it's building a blue water navy. Yeah. Do you think China is being realistic? Will its capabilities match its ambitions?
You know, I think that, nobody talks about this, but I think the PLA in China is fairly uncomfortable because they haven't fought a war since 1953, really. And Xi is taking a number of aggressive actions that are putting them in proximity with American forces, and the likelihood of an accidental clash escalating is going up, and so on. And I think a lot of people in the Chinese military leadership who have never fought a war and have all these fancy new toys and they've never actually tried to see if they all work together are a little uncomfortable being put in that position.
All right. So according to President Trump, China is also to blame for the apparent lack of progress with U.S. and North Korea relations. Do you agree?
No, that's just not true. I think, frankly, the fact that the Chinese and Russia both supported U.N. sanctions were what created the kind of pressure that led to the developments we've seen over the last, really, since January 1st. And so I think China's done actually more than, I think Trump had unrealistic expectations of what China can do. Our interests in China overlap on the Korean Peninsula, but they're not the same. China puts more value on stability, and the U.S. puts more emphasis on denuclearization. And I think the way Trump has done this has really given away the store. I think the Kim Jong-un deserves the Diplomatic Man of the Year award for the way he's really dictated the whole pace of diplomacy since his January 1st speech, the way he dealt with the Olympics in Seoul, and the way he manipulated Trump to have, you know, for Trump, the summit was the ultimate reality TV show.
Well, right now, the second round of talks were abruptly canceled by Pyongyang with no further dates given for the next summit. What will it take to restart the process?
Well, I think that they've made a number of mistakes. First, the U.S.
Okay.
First, when Trump met with the leadership, I think it was taken as a signal both in both Moscow and Beijing that it's okay to normalize relations with North Korea. And so the U.S. by defining it as a bilateral issue, remember we had six-party talks for a while that didn't ultimately achieve their objective, but it did show the major powers could cooperate and where their interests overlapped. And Trump's walked away from that and dealt with it as a bilateral U.S.-North Korea issue, which I think is a mistake because you can't solve this without China and Russia being involved. For example, on the nuclear issue, the IAEA can only monitor fissile material and facilities. They can't deal with nuclear weapons. That's something the PERM 5 and three of the PERM 5 happen to be in Northeast Asia, the U.S., China, and Russia. We ought to be talking to the other nuclear weapon states in Northeast Asia about how do we go about moving fissile material out of North Korea? How do we dismantle nuclear weapons? That's not going to happen magically. And I think to the degree that, or even our ally Japan's been cut out of the diplomacy. And so even they're quietly trying to meet with North Korea and so on because in order to solve this, we have to have a coordinated multilateral approach. And it's not happening. And I think even within the U.S. government, there's a gap between Trump and the whole Korea team under Secretary Pompeo, who are much more skeptical of Kim's intentions than President Trump, who said he fell in love.
Well, I mean, John Bolton, that Trump surely listens to, says that another North Korean summit needs to be held as Pyongyang is failing to deliver on its promises to denuclearize. I mean, the June summit was really purely for the show, for the reality show.
It was worse than that because if you read the statement that they put out, it was so vague that it didn't provide any guidance for how to put together a diplomatic process to actually realize any of the goals.
So what's the guarantee that the next summit will bring any tangible results?
I think it's a mistake.
To have a summit at all?
Yes, unless the North Koreans have boycotted two meetings that Secretary Pompeo has called. They were invited to Geneva by our North Korea special representative, who spent 2 days in Vienna waiting, and they never showed up. So I think they're playing Trump against his own government.
Hmm. You think that they're smart? Well, I think the root of the problem is maybe somewhere in a different place. Like, on paper, Pyongyang wants to normalize relations with the U.S., on paper, promising to denuclearize in return. But for Washington, denuclearization comes first. Could that be the root of the problem?
Well, no, that policy is not going to work. I mean, the North Koreans, whatever you think of their view, they've been consistent from day one. They said that we want a phased, synchronous process, which is the only way it can happen, because there's so much deep distrust on both sides that when we had the six-party talks, which I was somewhat involved in, it was called action for action, because the only way you build trust is if we do something and they do something and we each respond. And that's the only way I can see it working. And if the U.S. thinks North Korea is going to give up all its nukes and trust us to respond after they after we pocket all the concessions, that's just not going to happen.
But also Pyongyang sees nukes as the only real deterrent against American invasion.
Well,
giving them up is like demanding them for a leap of faith.
I can understand.
Why would they do that?
I can understand if I was North Korean, I might want a few nukes as a deterrent. However, I think you have a young leader who's 33 years old. Unlike his father, he wants to be around for a few decades, and he knows in order to do that, he has to modernize his economy. And if he has to trade some of his weapons of mass destruction or all of them to get that, I think there's been a lot of progress in North-South Korean reconciliation. And I can see a solution, but I'm not sure how you get there because of the deep distrust on both sides. And I mean, when the White House says we want a front-loaded solution, and when you ask them, well, do you have front-loaded benefits for North Korea if they give you all these things, you get a blank stare. And so I think I'm not sure that they've really thought through how this kind of diplomacy works.
You said earlier that neither China or America have answered main questions of why they are in the situation they are. So for me, for China, North Korea is arguably a buffer against U.S. troops right on its border and a point of leverage with the U.S. and actually for the rest of the world to a degree. For the United States, this is a pretext to keep troops in Asia and also project more power in Asia. So the way it looks to me, I mean, the prospect of war maybe is there, but it's very unlikely. It seems that the status quo is actually working for both powers at this point. Is there any will to change things?
I think it's not just the United States that's uncomfortable with North Korea as a nuclear weapons state. I think the Chinese would prefer to see a denuclearized Korean Peninsula as well, and so would Japan, and I think Russia as well doesn't look forward to more nuclear powers in the world. So, but you have a point that in the near term, the status quo, it's particularly because as the diplomacy has started, the things that were provoking the U.S., testing of long-range ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, has stopped. So there's less, the tensions are lower and there's less pressure. And so that's why I think the U.S., ironically, Trump has adopted the same policy as Obama of so-called strategic patience, although they don't call it that. But that's just, if you listen to what Trump and Pompeo are saying, we're in no rush, it's okay, we're doing well. I think that's going to change. The Democrats are taking over the House next month, and they're going to get hauled up to hearings to explain what they mean by all this great progress when, in fact, nothing has happened.
All right, Robert Manning, thank you very much for this interview. It's interesting to see what's going to happen in the first months to come.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.